KUNC's Colorado Edition. I'm Erin O'Toole, and this is a special episode for Veterans Day. We'll explore stories of veterans and their families. During the Vietnam War, Navy pilot Robert Wideman was captured by the enemy and taken to an interrogator.
And he says, "What city are you from?" I says, "I can't answer that question." He says, "Well, if you don't answer, I'm going to have my guards take you out and shoot."
The prisoners of war from that era are aging. We visit with Wideman at his home in Fort Collins to document his story and how he's working to preserve it for future generations. Then, the story of one woman in Greeley and her ongoing efforts to keep a promise she made to her husband before his jet went down during the Vietnam War. We'll also check in on a difficult subject, suicides. The Department of Veterans Affairs and vets themselves are fighting to reduce the rate, which is significantly higher for vets than the rest of the country. Joining me for those stories and more is KUNC's veterans reporter, Michael DeJuana. Welcome.
Hi, Erin.
So first, a little Veterans Day 101. Tell me about it.
Sure. I can give you a short history starting exactly 99 years ago.
Hold on. I thought you said this was going to be short.
Okay. But I also said history.
True.
And Veterans Day gets its start way back on November 11th, 1919.
Yeah.
That's the day Americans used to call
Armistice
Day. Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Which was the first anniversary of the end of the war to end all wars, the Great War, which later became World War I because it wasn't the war to end all wars after all.
They had to give it a number then.
Yes.
Okay. So 1919, that's when the national holiday started?
No. National observances didn't begin until 1926 by congressional decree. Huh. And the holiday wasn't recognized until 1938 on the brink of World War II. Years after that, in 1954, Dwight D. Eisenhower, a veteran himself, changed it to Veterans Day. I don't know if there was a conflict of interest in him doing that, but the idea was to honor all veterans, and most people, well, I think everyone was on board.
Yes, absolutely. Now, how many veterans are living in the U.S. today?
A little over 18 million, or about 5.5% of the country's population. 1.6 million of them are women, and about half of them are 65 years or older. And only about 9% are younger than 35.
Wow. And a lot of those younger ones, I'm guessing, have served in Afghanistan or Iraq.
Right. Yes. Of all ages, more than 52,000 troops have been wounded in action in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq since 2001.
Hmm. And you visited with one of those soldiers who was wounded.
Israel Del Toro. And to be fair, he's not a veteran yet. He's found a second act as a senior master sergeant teaching parachute jumping at the Air Force Academy after being injured.
Wow.
People call him DT. And I met with him at his home in Colorado Springs. And one of the first things I noticed on the wall along the staircase that goes down to his man cave in the basement were all the photos he has of him posing with famous people.
There's pictures of guys I met, athletes. Most of them are athletes because I love sports.
Oh, and there's Gary Sinise.
Gary Sinise knows me very well. George Lopez, of course, President Bush is all over the place.
There's even one of Britain's Prince Harry, a big supporter of adaptive sporting events for troops who were wounded like Del Toro.
This is his favorite picture of us. He even said, "I love this picture of me and UDT," and he even signed it with my quote, "Never effing quit."
Never effing quit. That has been a theme in Del Toro's life in just about every way imaginable.
Ladies and gentlemen, Master Sergeant Israel Del Toro Jr.
Del Toro's well known, too. He got a standing ovation from a room packed with sports heroes and celebrities at last year's ESPYs when he was honored with the Pat Tillman Award for dedication to service in sports.
To all my wounded, injured, ill service members, disabled civilians, or anyone who's having a bad day, I will stay strong for the ones who cannot. I will fight for the ones who cannot fight. I will never quit on you, and I will finish strong.
His acceptance speech takes on greater significance when you see how he got to this point. He joined the military in 1997, wanting a challenge in life, and because of 9/11, he deployed to war. In 2005, Del Toro was in Afghanistan when he was severely injured by an IED explosion.
I'm fired from head to toe, and then collapsing, thinking I'm going to die there. And a teammate helped me up, And luckily, there's a creek about 200 meters behind us, and we jumped into it to extinguish the flames.
Not fully aware of his injuries, he helped get word of the attack to an air team, and that's when things started to fade. Del Toro remembers thinking about his then 3-year-old son and bits of his rescue.
Flying off to our forward operating base, going into our field hospital, seeing some of my teammates there, my watch getting cut off.
It was December 4th, 2005.
I wake up March of 06.
He was at Brooke Army Medical Center in San Antonio, Texas, covered in bandages. He had third-degree burns over 80% of his body. Fingers were missing, and the doctors began telling him he'd never walk again or breathe without a respirator.
Everyone's like waiting to see what I'm going to say. They're all looking. And I couldn't talk because I had a trach, so they were just reading my lips. But what I repeated was some colorful words, but pretty much I told them, you know, you can go to hell.
His recovery and therapy was off the charts painful.
So my hands, you could have rubbed a feather across and it felt like you were cutting me with razor blades. And then learning how to walk, you think it's easy, but it's probably some of the most painful stuff I had to go through. But every day I had to do it because I wanted to show my son, if you kept a positive mind, if you find that fire inside of you, you'll overcome any odds.
By far, Del Toro exceeded the expectations of his doctors. In 2 months, he was ready to go home, but he found himself struggling, filled with doubt.
The only time I had ever wished I died was when I first saw my face. And it wasn't a vanity thing. It really wasn't. If I thought I was a monster, it's like, God, what's my 3-year-old son going to think?
He listened to his wife, Carmen, and a therapist who told him that his son really just wants his dad.
I was like, okay. So I'll just keep going. And so when I finally saw him when I got out of the hospital, you know, he comes running out. And, you know, I'm all bandaged up. And he stops. And all that fear comes rushing back. It's like, oh my God, he's terrified of me. He's not going to want to hold me. And he looks, tilts his head to the side, and he says, Papi. I'm like, yeah, buddy. And he comes up and gives me the most amazing hug I've ever had.
Wow, that's powerful. So what happened after that hug?
DT could have said, that's it, I'm done. And he could have left the military with full benefits as a disabled veteran. But instead, in 2010, he did something different. Remember his quote, never having quit?
Yes.
Well, he convinced the Air Force to allow him to stay.
I still had a job to do. So that's what I did.
And now he's a shining example of what's possible in so many ways for people if they adapt to each other and focus on strengths instead of limitations.
I was showing the military that I still had value.
Israel Del Toro also credits sports with his recovery. He's been super active in competitions for Wounded Warriors over the years. In 2016, he won a gold medal for shot put at Prince Harry's Invictus Games. Now he's got his eyes set on the Paralympic Games in 2020.
Why do I feel like there's no doubt he'll be there?
Yeah.
And strong. Yeah. Well, meanwhile, this year is a milestone for a certain group of survivors of the Vietnam War. It is the 45th anniversary of the return of the American prisoners of war.
Right. Hundreds of POWs came home in 1973, 662 of them to be exact. And they're getting up there in years. About a third of them are believed to have passed away.
Right. I mean, they must be a lot older, probably in their mid-70s by now.
Exactly. Or older. And it's one reason why, as a reporter, I'm making a conscious effort to meet more Vietnam-era veterans.
And one of them was a prisoner of war.
Yeah. Retired Navy pilot Robert Weidman of Fort Collins. I sat down with him in his home office to show him something that I found in reporting the story. It was some grainy old film footage. It's just images, no sound. He adjusts his glasses and runs his hand over his gray hair.
I've never seen this. Never.
It's March 4th, 1973. That's the day Weidman and dozens of other prisoners of war were released in Hanoi. They're lined up in two neat rows, dressed in the same gray jackets, black trousers, and...
Everybody got a haircut.
Soldiers with the North Vietnamese Army watch as each former prisoner walks up to a smiling American officer. They salute, shake hands, and each gets a friendly pat on the back.
Here's me.
This footage would have been lost if a military museum in Maine hadn't rescued it from the trash and posted it online.
How did you feel right then?
I was just, at that point, I'm waiting to get on the plane and waiting for the wheels to come up. Because they could have called that off at any time.
He's been talking about his experiences lately as he tours with his book. He said he wanted to tell his story before he gets too old to tell it. Unexpected Prisoner recounts his nearly 6 years in captivity, including time at the famed Hanoi Hilton, where Senator John McCain, who passed away this summer, was held. On May 6, 1967, the skies over northern Vietnam were clear. That afternoon, Weidman found himself tumbling through the air.
And I can see between my feet, you know, the blue sky and the ground and the sky and the ground.
The control stick in his A-4 Skyhawk jet had jammed, and he couldn't stop it from going down. So he launched the ejection seat.
And then all of a sudden, the parachute just opened up. I looked out at the coast about 2 miles away, and I thought about my wife and my brother and my family. And then I made a couple transmissions. You know, Raven Lee, this is two, how do you read? I got no response. Then about that time, I heard a whistling sound of a bullet going by me.
He hit the ground with two broken fingers and a messed up shoulder. An enemy soldier was standing just 25 yards away.
He's just waiting to see what I'm going to do. I just turned my palms of my hands up, and then he dropped his hands, and all these people charged me. They all had knives, and they cut me out of everything. They had me down to my underwear in about 30 seconds.
Weidman was then whisked away to a nearby hut.
He sit me down, blindfold me, tied my hands behind my back, and we just waited. Rescue planes came in. And there was a war going on for about 45 minutes.
But there was no rescue. Soon he was struggling to stay on his feet while marching through rice paddies and hostile villages to a truck that brought him to a dark room where an interrogator was waiting.
And he says, "What city are you from?" I says, "I can't answer that question." He says, "Well, if you don't answer, I'm going to have my guards take you out and shoot you." Then he asked me again. I says, "I'd really like to answer your question, but my government won't let me answer."
The ropes around his arms were cinched so tightly that it felt like they were barbed wire cutting to the bone. His arms turned purple, and he started convulsing. He shouted that he'd never talk. And then he gave in.
He says, "What city are you from?" I says, "Cleveland, Ohio." He says, "Okay, Robert. They like to call me Robert. Now you may go to sleep." So they hog-tied me to that 2x4, and I went to sleep.
It was just the beginning of his torture. Eventually, he wound up in a small windowless room in Hanoi with a few other POWs.
No books, no games, no nothing. It was just boring. I mean, I counted squares on the ceiling.
His fellow POWs kept him company, but the conversation became routine. Months dragged on, but with them came the possibility for change. In 1968, following the Tet Offensive attacks on the U.S., President Lyndon Johnson began to outline a path to peace.
"We are reducing, substantially reducing, the present level of hostilities."
In December of that year, Weidman received something that raised his hopes, a package from home with a bar of French milled soap and photos, including of his wife, Patricia, who he said looked gorgeous, and one of his brother, who also fought in Vietnam.
He had those big pork chop sideburns, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Mutton chops.
Mutton chops, yeah. But I was just so glad he was still alive.
1969 brought more hope. Though there was still torture, conditions were slowly improving for a few reasons, including the passing of North Vietnam's leader, Ho Chi Minh. And in the U.S., POW families drew attention to their loved ones. By mid-1970, Weidman and others had moved to a new location in Hanoi.
We had big windows, and we're getting out twice a day for 2 or 3 hours at a time. We're getting 2 baths a day.
There was hope that they'd go home soon, but it turned out they'd be held for 3 more years. And Aaron, that brings us right up to 1973.
The year the POWs were released.
Yes, and that video I found, the one that Robert Weidman had never seen before, to me, it's history. But to Weidman, it's one of the best days of his whole life. It was like traveling back in time to his 20s. You know, he joked that he was a lot thinner back then. And there's a little dark humor in that.
Yeah.
And that smile, though, no doubt that he was happy to leave it all behind.
So that's what he was feeling then, you know, happiness, joy.
A mixture of that and something else. When the POWs all got on the plane to start the long trek home, Robert's smile disappeared.
Boy, the freaking plane took off, and when the wheels came in, I just started crying. You know, this freaking ordeal is over.
Through the years, he says he struggled emotionally. When he finally went to a Veterans Affairs clinic, he was told the same thing as 30% of his fellow Vietnam-era vets.
Oh, you got post-traumatic stress.
All these years later, he says little things can still set him off. But some things help, like Bible studies and this.
Wow.
His 6 grandkids. After working in business, in law, and then as a flight simulator instructor, Weidman fully retired in 2012, leaving his home in Mississippi for Fort Collins. Luckily for him, all his grandchildren live in the area, and several are at this soccer park with their parents. I asked one of them, 8-year-old Max, to tell me about his granddad.
He was in the Civil War.
How does that feel, Robert?
Perfect answer.
The Vietnam War.
The Vietnam War. And he's cool.
So while Robert Weidman came home from the Vietnam War, there are those who never did.
There were 58,220 military deaths in that war, but for hundreds of them, there has never been a funeral.
Why is that?
Well, simply because their bodies were never found or are too difficult to recover.
Mm. So what happens in those cases?
There's actually a little-known agency in the U.S. Defense Department that to this day works painstakingly to find missing remains so they can be returned home for a funeral.
Right. I remember actually 1 or 2 headlines about the remains of, I think, World War II troops being identified and laid to rest.
Yeah, one of the stories was the remains of Navy gunner's mate William Helstern. He was among the 429 USS Oklahoma crew members to die during the Pearl Harbor attack in 1941, and he was buried in the shared plot. He was only 20 at that time. Well, that little-known agency, the Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, or DPAA, contacted Helstern's family, got a DNA sample, and found a match.
Wow.
So Helstern's nephew, Ted Hummel, who lives in Castle Rock, said when the news came, he just broke down.
I started bawling, just started bawling. Because I've grown up with this, you know, his medals, some newspaper stuff like that. I just started bawling like a baby. I couldn't believe it. And then about a week and a half later, 2 officers from the Navy came to my house and met me. They brought me a book with printed his hand, copies of his handwritten form to enlist, a form that my grandpa had to sign to let him go in because he was only 17. And then they told me to pick out a date. They would fly him anywhere in the country. I wanted him to go.
So all these decades later, gunner's mate, second class William Helstern, was laid to rest on May 18th in a cemetery in Wheat Ridge.
Can I just say it's amazing that the DPAA can do this kind of work?
It is. It's a modern marvel.
Needle in a haystack kind of things.
Yes, but they're not always successful, which can bring frustration to some families. Take another case, the one of Mike Klingner, who served in the Vietnam War. I first told his story late last year. He was the drummer in a rock and roll band back in the mid-1960s, and I asked his bandmates to dig up the old tapes out of the boxes, and this was the only one they could find with his voice on it.
Hi, this is Dick Clark, speaking to you for Ben Simmons, The Story That Thinks Young. In just a moment, I'll have for you the news from the Hollywood Hotline.
1, 2, 3, go!
Klingner is doing his best imitation of radio host Dick Clark. It may be the only record left of his voice, which is kind of appropriate since everyone I spoke to said he was a funny guy and a great friend.
Now, why did you want this tape?
I wanted to bring it to his girlfriend from back in the day, and I wanted to share it with her.
I never imagined I'd ever hear his voice again. I feel that same warm feeling. I can still picture him, imagine his sense of humor, his warmth.
And that's her, Jane Addams of Greeley. Eventually, Klingner left the band. He joined the Air Force, and in 1968, he married Jane Addams. Then, after their first anniversary, Addams remembers saying goodbye to him at an airport.
In those days, you could still go to the gate to see people off on the airplane. So I could watch him go up the stairs. He got to the top of the stairs, turned, and looked at the window where I was standing. And that's the last time I ever saw him.
He went off to the Vietnam War as a jet pilot.
Tui Wan, located on a 3-mile stretch of beach along the South China Sea, is one of four new air bases.
Mike Klingner flew many missions from that air base. On April 6, 1970, he attacked an enemy supply chain. That's when his jet burst into flames and crashed into a dense jungle hillside.
The military came to my apartment, and they came with a priest, which was standard. And this is all I was given.
This letter.
It is with deep personal concern that I officially inform you that your husband, First Lieutenant Michael L. Klingner, is missing in action.
He was just 24 years old. A year later, Klingner was listed as killed in action, even though his body had not been found. Addams mourned, but never held a funeral. And then, life went on. She remarried in 1973 and started a family in Greeley, Colorado. But she's never given up hope that her husband's remains might be found.
Mike said the night before he left, he said, if I'm killed in action, I want to be buried in Arlington.
Sitting at her kitchen table, she shares memories from over the years. There are band flyers, wedding photos, a distinguished flying cross for heroic action, and the closest thing she has of Mike.
What is that?
Sock. This is the remnant of sock, and it's lined up with a standard sock that the military would have worn at that time to compare. Just these are the fragments that were found at his site.
It wasn't until the mid-1990s that search teams first set foot on Mike Klingner's crash site. They located pieces of his jet, found bits of his uniform, but the site hasn't been fully excavated, and a decade has passed since investigators were last there. It's why the case is still open. The U.S. Defense Department met with families in Washington, D.C. for its annual briefing about troops still missing from the Vietnam War. Jane Addams was there. Inside a Hilton conference room are specialists from the military's Defense POW/MIA accounting agency. Families call it the DPAA. Addams presses casualty resolution specialist Alvin Teal for answers.
Are there possible explanations how fragments of his clothing and survival gear have been recovered, but yet no trace of the person who was wearing them at the time of impact?
When that body hits, it basically breaks or explodes with the aircraft, so it can fragment.
It's the kind of frustrating answer that many families get. and a reason why Congress put pressure on the agency to get more done.
You know, it's a military creed to leave no one behind.
Johnny Webb is the DPAA's Deputy Director of Outreach and Communication. Prior to 2015, he says they were resolving about 88 cases a year.
And so we've done a lot to develop that capability and capacity. And in doing so, we have increased the number of identifications that we have made.
In more recent years, the agency has hovered at the threshold that Congress wants, 200 or more cases a year, and for all conflicts, including Korea and World War II.
We are now disinterring unknowns from our cemeteries.
But relatively few Vietnam cases are being resolved. That worries Ann Mills Griffiths. She's the CEO of the nonprofit National League of POW/MIA Families.
It is better to have certainty about what happened.
She says there's a feeling that time is running out. In recent years, she received information about her brother, Lieutenant Commander James B. Mills, whose plane vanished during the Vietnam War.
To know that, in fact, my brother crashed along the coastline in shallow water off the coast of northern Vietnam. That's much better than knowing what we knew before.
And on this point, the DPAA is frank. There can't be an accounting for all 83,000 cases it has, but experts believe up to 40% do have potential, including hundreds from the Vietnam War. That's what keeps Jane Addams going. Back in the hotel conference room, she has one last question for Alvin Teal.
Where is Mike on the priority list?
Because we considered an open site, mm-hmm. we consider that the priority. We want to get the sites done.
In 2000, Mike Klingner's friends thought if there couldn't be a funeral, he should at least have a memorial service. His bandmate Stan Johnson traveled to his hometown in Nebraska to play the bugle.
I came out to McCook, and they dedicated a portion of the library to him, and a past governor was there, and just everybody we were talking, and everybody thought, well, I thought I was Mike's best friend. You know, he treated us so nicely.
Klingner was also posthumously inducted into Nebraska's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame through the band Jay Harrison B and the Bumbles.
The mic was always there, rapping out with his hands on the bar, the rhythm, the drums. He was an entertainer.
Retired Air Force Colonel William Hosmer was one of Klingner's commanders in Vietnam.
He was just fun to be around. He was a live wire in a quiet bar. He was a positive force, and he brought the minds and the hearts of the pilots on the same frequency, and he just stood out.
And it's those same qualities that won Jane Addams over all those years ago. She wants to keep her word and bring her first husband home to that final resting place he wanted at Arlington National Cemetery.
That would be really really helpful in closing that chapter and feeling satisfied that we've kept that promise.
And Jane Addams told me that even just a piece of Mike Klingner's remains, like even a tooth, that would be enough to bring to Arlington.
Wow. Well, the DPAA said the site is a priority. So when will it return to his crash site to look for his remains?
Well, that's unknown. Adams told me that the agency recently announced sites it will explore from the Vietnam War, but Klingner's crash site wasn't on that list. So she's still waiting and still hoping.
One very difficult subject among veterans is suicides. They occur at a significantly higher rate than for the rest of the country. That's according to the Department of Veterans Affairs.
The VA is working on the issue, and I recently spoke with their top official on the issue. And though they're doing a lot, the numbers are stubborn.
Right. Okay, well, In the meantime,
I sat down with Mark Drake. He's a Vietnam vet, and I wanted to get his insights. So we met for coffee in Longmont. He's red in the face and smiling.
I was cranking so hard on the way back.
He's a little sweaty, too. Drake just finished 18 miles on his low-riding, hand-cranked bicycle. We're at the supermarket Starbucks by his house.
You know, and I was just flying. I was hitting 20 miles an hour. It's a joy to be alive.
This seemed like an odd place to talk about his war experiences and such a heavy issue, veteran suicide. But he insisted.
This is a safe place for me. Safeway?
Yeah, over coffee, he tells me he was born in California and that he moved around a lot as a kid.
He moved to Tennessee, moved to Colorado, moved to New Mexico, moved back to Colorado.
In 1969, he joined the Army because he thought he'd eventually be drafted if he didn't.
15th Med Battalion, which is Medevac.
Drake had conscientious objections, so the military made him a medic. And once he set foot in Vietnam, he found meaning in helping to save the lives of others.
The downside of the coin in Medevac was that also all the KIAs, the killed in actions, all the dead, you know, the soldiers. And that was a tough part.
The life and death he witnessed marked him. They're at the heart of the post-traumatic stress that he still experiences. It took decades for him to fully see how the war had affected him.
I'd always had certain issues, but I didn't realize really what they were.
For instance, he'd startle easily, he couldn't sleep, and when he did, he had nightmares. Then, about 20 years ago, he can't recall exactly when, a crisis changed everything.
I had suicidal thoughts. It's called ideation. And immediately I realized what it was, that this was out of the ordinary and that I needed to seek treatment.
According to the Department of Veterans Affairs annual report on suicides, veterans take their own lives at more than 2 times the rate of non-veterans. That's 20 per day. It's a number that remains relatively unchanged.
I don't want to say this is positive, but it's a start in the right direction. I mean, at least they're not rising.
Keita Franklin is executive director of the VA's National Suicide Prevention Program.
One suicide is too many, and they're all tragic, and so we're definitely trying to develop interventions.
The numbers in the VA's report are already dated, with 2015 being the most recent year cited. Still, it reveals not only a stubborn death toll, but myriad complexities. For instance, 40% of those who took their own lives did not have a mental health diagnosis.
They're struggling with relationship problems or legal struggles or financial struggles, employment and the like. It's not always mental health.
That hasn't stopped the VA from responding with a number of changes and initiatives in recent years. Everything from expanding a crisis line to support plans for troops transitioning to civilian life. There's even a website for family and friends, betherforveterans.com. Another factor highlighted in the report are different outcomes for those who recently received VA care versus those who had not.
That's an interesting phenomenon in the report this time. Like, if they're not in VA health care, we see those rates rising faster. So we think it points to the fact that, you know, getting into care helps.
Suicide, especially veteran suicide, is a national problem, but it has a local solution. And the local solution is the community coming together.
Dwayne France is a veteran and a mental health therapist in Colorado Springs. Besides stigma, he says access to health care is a problem for too many veterans.
Another challenge is that veterans aren't using the mental health resources at the rate that they possibly should have, and that there are barriers to that access.
Back at the Safeway in Longmont, Mark Drake says that when he felt suicidal, he didn't worry about how to access care. He just asked for emergency suicide help, and it came.
Don't be afraid to ask for help.
Support from his family helped, too, as do his friends, especially other veterans.
My buddies are all really frank, and we've been together for years. It goes back to that. We all were cut from the same cloth.
Andy has his hand cycle. He started riding several years ago when the polio he contracted as a kid weakened his legs too much to ride a two-wheeler.
Oh, golly. Cycling has saved my life. I've been a cyclist since I was a kid. And the endorphins that you get from it, it allows me to completely focus on one thing, staying alive on the road.
Well, obviously a sense of humor helps, too.
Yes, clearly it does. But it still is so sad that 20 veterans a day are taking their own lives. And the VA, you know, with all of its programs, hasn't really changed that fact.
Yes, and I want to put a finer point on one thing that everyone in my story said. Getting into care with the VA is so important. The VA says come in, even if you haven't come in before, and ask for help. Of course, in my years of reporting, including with NPR's investigative desk, I've revealed that tens of thousands of troops might not be able to get VA care.
And are you talking about your stories of veterans who served in Afghanistan and Iraq and were discharged with mental health issues or brain injuries?
Yes. And the problem is that they were also accused of misconduct and discharged for that. Nobody should get away with flouting the rules. But we found that the misconduct could be minor, and experts say misconduct can be a symptom of their combat injuries, and the troops should get care instead of booted out without access to health benefits.
Right. And as I recall, that reporting led to some developments that materialized earlier this year.
It was buried in the details of the enormous $1.3 trillion omnibus spending bill that passed in spring. Congress gave the green light to what's called the Veteran Urgent Access to Mental Health Care Act.
Nice ring to it.
Yeah. It helps veterans with misconduct discharges get care from the VA, including urgent mental health care.
And does this link to the suicide issue?
Some think it can reduce them, including the law's House sponsors, Derek Kilmer, a Washington Democrat, and Mike Kaufman, a Republican from here in Colorado. But it's too early yet to tell if they will.
Veterans Day is Sunday, although it's officially observed on Monday. There's a run in Denver, there's a parade in Colorado Springs, and lots of other events all around the state to honor veterans. But there's something more personal you can do too, right?
Yeah. If you don't know a veteran, I hope you'll reach out and get to know one. It's not just about saying thanks for your service. It's not just about being there one day a year. It's about building a strong community around our veterans.
Yeah.
And, you know, think about being a friend to a veteran the other 364 days out of the year.
Exactly. And, Michael, I know you'll continue to keep an eye on these issues affecting veterans in the months and years to come.
Yep, will do.
That was KUNC's military and veterans reporter, Michael DeJoanna. And I'm Erin O'Toole. Thanks for listening to this special episode of Colorado Edition. Our show this week was produced by me and Michael, with support from managing editor Brian Larson. Ashley Jeffcoat handles the digital side. Music we heard in this episode was Time Passing by David Hillowitz, Glimpse of Eternity by Maiden, Fragile Rain by Junya Nishimura, and incidental music by Jay Harrison B. and the Bumbles in our story about Jane Addams. Our intro music is Remember Me by Colorado musician Kalatana. Our outro music is from Peterloo Massacre, Never Forget. To ensure that you never miss an episode, you can subscribe at KUNC.org or wherever you listen to podcasts. And join us next Sunday evening at 9 on KUNC.